Tom, you have a mic. You planning to do something with it?
I'm thinking about what I want to say. We had a pretty good discussion kind of in the late afternoon. It was kind of partly prompted by comments, I guess, that were made by Jay that were probably not exactly what he was talking about. We were talking about, you know, what principles mean and you know, what we want to do as a center. And so we kind of had a meta-level discussion about that. But, you know, I think one of the things that we're trying to, I think, do under Initiative 4 is, on the one hand, really try to think about how various kinds of computational principles apply across different aspects of learning and across different scales of learning. And, you know, one good example is looking at kind of Bayesian models, because if in the context of the kinds of models that I do, if I can, you know, trying to model the dynamics of individual decisions, you have essentially accumulations of likelihood ratios taking place at kind of really small time scale. So you have this kind of Bayesian, these Bayesian models kind of driving these kind of decision processes, but then it takes place also at the level of saccades, and it takes place at the level of kind of global decisions. So you have these same kind of computational principles that are occurring in at different timescales, but also occurring across different aspects of learning. So in that sense, you can have principles applying to different domains of learning, different kinds of learning, and so I think that's one of the things that kind of as a center, it's useful to kind of see those connections. And just in the context of the discussions that we had, I mean, Terry brought up, you know, some of the stuff they've been doing, looking at how tuning of perceptual representations can lead to priming. I think, I don't know if it was short term or long term, sharpening. Right. So sharpening of representations, and I think that's maybe at a context of a smaller time scale, but it's kind of revealing itself in the dynamics of the decision process. And that's effectively some of the stuff we've been doing, looking at sharpening and tuning of perceptual representations leading to the kinds of long-term changes that you see when people get faster at categorizing things at different levels of abstraction. So being able to have those discussions, and this is just kind of came up in the context of sitting around a table trying to make sense of what happened in Initiative 4, that there are these connections. And I think one of the things we want to do is on the one hand have an opportunity for the modelers to really talk about the details of what they're doing, because we typically bypass that in these kinds of audiences, because people aren't usually interested in those details if they're not the modelers. So you really need to have an opportunity for the modelers to talk, but you don't want to have the modelers be isolated from the rest of the group, because then it becomes something that isn't really applicable to what other people are doing.
Paula?
Yes. Well, one of the other things that keeps popping up in my mind from a lot of different levels is the parallels between some of the theoretical issues in different fields. And one of the ones that I forgot to mention that came up in our discussion is the issue of modularity in the categorization area. Are faces special? And in my area, for years, the field has been dominated by the question, is speech special? And what the effects of those, and Jay and I go, but what the effects of those kinds of theories have had on a field for very long periods of time in terms of driving research agendas and directions is really important. So it's very interesting when I was listening to you, Tom, that you're talking about categorization, talking about Terry's issue about sharpening. Well, you know, representation of speech phonemes is really absolutely critical for so many different aspects of language and reading development. And there could be very similar principles. We don't know, but it's a question that could be asked in terms of what are the principles that drive sharpening of the phoneme representations, and what are the learning principles involved. And are they similar or different from the development of expertise in other areas?
So one of the things that seems obvious emerging from all of this, and that came up in each initiative meeting that I was in, was that it really is time for us to think positively, basically, as though we will end up continuing the center with full funding and begin really going ahead and solidifying plans for experiments that will really nail our issues. I mean, I think we are to the point where many of the experimentalists and the modelers are finding common ground. Those models can drive our experiments to many extents. You know, for example, some of us who have been looking at error analysis, well, those might just be, you know, people, animals sampling, and that's very interesting to begin looking with new perspectives on simple behavioral issues, and to also reverse engineer the neurobiology of some of our experiments and get some of the same measurements that humans get in animals that we ordinarily wouldn't take to try to make those comparisons. So there are these Uber experiments, basically, that we could begin planning as a center, and I think it's really a good idea to start actually designing some of those experiments and vetting them in advance so that we're ready to take off.
So any other modelers? I mean, Peter, you just came an awful long way from, do you want to say something? Terry, go ahead, fine.
So one of the issues that came up was the fact that we actually can't keep track of everything that's going on, and that we need a wiki or something like it so that if there is a collaboration that comes up and someone's doing something across initiatives, that we can at least document that. I mean, if no other reason, then you know, we can show NSF what we're doing. And there are, I happen to know, there are some secret research projects going on, not secret in the sense of, you know, they don't want anybody to know about it, but in fact, very few people know, for example, that Andrea and Peter are doing something together.
It's a secret only in the fact that it's been forgotten since it started about 5 years ago.
No, but I mean, I suspect there's more of that going on, you know, that we just don't know about.
Would you like to lay this rumors to rest, Peter? Or?
I just want to say that, you know, I think there's an awful lot of modeling going on. You hear that, you know, there are many of the networks, many of the initiatives have very sophisticated models. But one issues are that they're not necessarily agreeing on the terminology. So even models which are the same actually may look different. And so I think the issues like Mike was talking about, where in fact many of these salience models may actually be quite closely related. And so, you know, to develop a common terminology, you need to talk to each other. And you know, there isn't a modelers network in a sense. I mean, there's initiative four, but that's only as one group of the people. And so somehow you have to talk to each other to actually generate this common language and work out what the commonalities are. And in order to actually make actually work out where the disagreements between the models really are. And if you want to do experimental tests, you're trying to test between models is one natural thing to do. And you haven't got the models which are in the same space enough to, in order to make those tests actually be acute. And so I think that's really a critical issue for you know, as you're thinking about these Andrea's Uber experiments, to think about that.
Any others on this issue? A lot of people haven't spoken. Any comments? Susie, do you have any comments on any of these things? Julie? Ginny, do you want to speak about this? It's not required, but if you... Okay. Mike?
Gary
has some thoughts.
And Sue.
Yeah, so I think a modelers network is a great idea. We do plan to have modelers meetings as soon as we get some money for them. That's an excellent suggestion to work out the differences between the models. One thing I did want to mention that I was talking to Bill last night from SLC and our Scientific Learning Corporation. And they do have a wealth of data that we could be using, of mouse click by mouse click, of kids using FAST for Word. They get 3 gigabytes of new data a day. They have pre-tests and post-tests. They have, you know, the trajectory of the learning through the whole situation. One of the things that came up earlier in the education initiative was talking about individual differences between learners, and this is a database we could mine for that. As I said during that meeting, anyone who has more than one child knows there's big individual differences, and what I'd like to see, you know, it it's not exactly modeling learning. It's more like a data mining question. But if you know, we applied some of these powerful new statistical models to this kind of data, perhaps we could pull out things that would be able to predict which kids are fast forward going to work for, and you know, what alternative paths should they take through the software if they look like this at the beginning. And so for those of us at UCSD, Bill's going to come down and give a talk at the AI group about this data set at some point. Yeah.
So let's go back to that after the break, because we've got the whole education thing. Let's just do Susie. I see there's people beginning to stream out for coffee. No pressure now, but...
Okay, I'll just make it a quick point about modeling at different levels. I guess to come back to some remarks that Javier made about the danger of modelers sort of modeling specific tasks and getting sort of a bit too pigeonholed. But on the other hand, I would say, and there are a lot of modelers in these different networks that are developing interesting models at different levels, like Paul Monroe is doing models of STDP and sort of low-level synaptic-level phenomena. Various people are working on temporal difference learning models that address, you know, reinforcement learning and other aspects and connect to other data sets. And, you know, Gary's got models of salience and so on. And I think that it's actually also kind of healthy to develop models at these different levels that connect with data in very different ways. And so we shouldn't expect this one Uber theory of learning and the brain, but that, you know, ultimately all models are probably wrong anyways, but the job of the modelers is to push on them and break them and compare them to other models and see, do they make new predictions, or if they don't, then they're broken and they need to be extended and elaborated. So it's healthy to have this diversity of modeling, and it's also healthy for the modelers to get together and figure out how they can make contact maybe with similar data and compare across the models.
Okay, so we're talking about the trainees now. The trainees had, there were two breakout sessions that had to do with trainee activities. One of them was very specific, included only trainees participating, and it was about how they want to use the $10,000 that they were allotted. And I will let them, I wasn't part of that session, I will maybe have Janet talk about what they decided to do. The other session had trainees and PIs and focused on the activities of the trainee committee and also the experiences of the trainees as part of the center. And I'll just say a few words about this, but again, I think the trainees have, you know, it'd be better to hear from them. And they, I now heard that they had a meeting after the meeting, and I wasn't part of that either. So they can tell you about all of this. So the good part is that, you know, the trainees have organized quite a bit since the last site visit, and I think this is quite a success. And we can probably do better on that side. The one thing I want to say, because I think it should come from me, is that it's really important for the PIs to be aware of the importance of encouraging your trainees to participate in some of these activities. So I've said it before the break, and I want to say it again. You need to mention the center activities. You know, at your lab meetings, you need to tell your trainees to participate in online meetings. You will hear about this 10K, the money, and how, you know, the trainee committees is proposing to have some very short grant proposals for that. Well, you will, from experience, because we've done this in Penn, we set aside money for travel awards and small research projects for the trainees, and we announced it, and it takes the PIs to recognize in some of the ideas the trainees have that there's a potential there for a project. And so you tell your, oh, you need to write a little proposal, you know, it's one page or something, to get that money to do this. Because the trainees usually don't do that on their own, you know. But then when they do it, they really, really benefit from it. And so it's really important that the PIs you know, remember this. So I think I'm going to have Janet.
Oh, okay. I just stand here. So I just give a quick recap about the things that we talk about at the Chinik only session. So I think it's a really great opportunity to not only for the people in the Chinik committee to really sit down face to face and have interaction. And also we also get a lot of feedback from other Chinese about the issues that we've been talked about a lot, but we didn't really have a chance to know about what other Chinese thought about several issues. So I'll just do a quick recap. So the first thing we talk about is that over these few months, right now there are five Chinese in the Chinese committee, and we help organize online meetings that Isabel already mentioned, that we really try hard to, because this is a very, I think online meetings, it's multi-online meetings within each network, it's really an important opportunity for Chinese to have interaction with the PIs to get involved in the network research. So we figure that it's important for us to really collaborate with PIs to organize this regular online, regular network online meetings. And this one thing we talk about at the meeting. And another thing is that we figure that over these few months, I think it's a great opportunity that we have a Chinese committee, and we are able to get involved in center issues, and it's like an interface for us to talk to the center. And at the same time, we feel that maybe it's time for us to recruit more people into a Chinese committee. On one hand, that we can share work, and on the other, because as you can feel that we hope to help to organize several different activities at the center. And on the other hand, we will get different perspectives from the other Chinese. So right now, we think that maybe it's appropriate. We want to propose that at least we will have two Chinese from each network in our Chinese committee. And ideally, it will be one graduate student and one postdoc. So sometimes postdoc and graduate students, they have different perspectives. So also over here, I also want to encourage the Chinese over here, if you are interested in participating center activities, help organizing center events, then please feel free to contact me or any members at the Chinese committee. And okay, in addition to this, we also briefly talk about. Should we point them out? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So this Leanne and Paul and Lara. Yeah, Paul is over there, and Lara over there. And Mike. Mm-hmm. Okay. And me. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay, so in addition to this, we also talk about whether there's some communication methods for us to kind of an easier way to communicate with the center, and not just for the Chinese, probably also for everyone at the center. For example, we have a website, but we don't really use it frequently. Yeah.
So something that I forgot to communicate to everyone is that we have been working with CalIT2, who has almost finished. Actually, it's not working that well. I'd hoped to demo it at this meeting, and then I got it at the last minute, and I tried it out, and a number of things didn't work, even though they said it would work. But there's a members-only site now. So we will be able to log into a members-only site. It will have a center calendar on it. Right now it has a wiki on it also, which is password protected separately. And we'll have internal center news that we don't necessarily want to send out to the public also on that members only site. So there's already a login, and what will happen is you'll be able to log in, and then there'll be someone in our center that clears you as okay to be on that or not based on our center's lists. And then you'll be privy to the members only site. And in addition to that, actually there's going to be our administrative database is at the alpha stages also, the new administrative database where we'll be entering data for the reports and things like that. So we have developed better tools, and you'll be getting emails within the next couple weeks probably about login to our new members only site, but not until the executive committee has taken their pass at it to kind of vet it.
I have a question, and that is whether or not there would be, we need a way of making it really easy for, no, easy for people to remember to acknowledge the TDLC when they publish a paper, and also to make sure that we have a place to upload papers, PDFs, of work that has come out of the center, so it's really easy for the rest of us to go onto the website and just see what's been published recently and give us a lot more information about the science that's being accumulated.
Sorry, this is getting off of the trainee stuff, but I just made me think of this. And that one of the suggestions that people had, someone had, was that the talks and posters that people have given at the All Hands, we should find a place on the website where we can put those, because sometimes people want to be able to go back and just remind themselves about something that happened, because then it could spur further discussion. Now, we have to think of the logistics, but we might think about trying to make those available to people.
I just wondered if you could try to articulate what the vision was for the trainees as far as what this committee is supposed to do for them. Will they be talking to one another about maybe starting projects together? Would they be talking about maybe being a bridge person in another lab? I mean, as compared to what might be happening at the other levels in the center, what's special about the trainee group that will be valuable for the trainees who participate?
So I think I will just talk about the what trainee committee is doing. So the goal of the trainee committee is basically provide the interface that for the trainees can participate in their decisions about the center, or they can know more about the research, or they can know they can let the PIs know that what they want, what they want to learn, what they hope that the center can provide, what their expectations is. So, for example, like at the training committee, the training session, I actually got several feedback about, for example, we hope that maybe, for example, we want to have regular some workshops that can help us, for example, like a career day, tell us how to do job hunting, or how to maybe a workshop for grant proposal writing, teach us how to kind of like a career develop tools. Yeah, so these are the things that the trainees that they want to learn. And
yeah, just to give you a bit of a perspective for when, you know, this, there was no trainee committee before the site visit, and during the site visit, this came up that NSF wanted to have a private meeting with the trainees. They had that discussion, and the site visitors, you know, had concerns about the involvement of the trainees in the activity of the center. The fact that they sometimes weren't aware of what was going on, and that they didn't have a voice in our decisions. And so that was one motivation for the trainee committee. I think the other, you know, to be honest, the other motivation is that the trainees are a wonderful resource. We have a complex structure here and not a whole lot of money for administrative support. You know, in Penn, we have a coordinator. It's wonderful to have a coordinator to organize activities, schedule activities, you know, and all that. In the other networks, this doesn't exist yet. And so the trainees are a great resource to do things like organize online meetings, get together and think of things that they'd like to have, that they would have the center do for them, and then and put it together. And they, you know, they're starting to do this very well. So it's not, the trainee committee per se is not working at the scientific level, although they are talking about what the trainees can do to help, but it's more organizational. And it hasn't been a lot of work, I think, for the trainees. I mean, I think we've been frustrated with some issues of the ability to contact people easily and all of this, and we have to work on this. But, you know, does this answer your question? Okay.
Okay, great. Gary wants to...
One When we say we want the trainees to have a voice, Janet actually comes to the what we call the cabal, the executive committee meetings, and she doesn't say much, but but she could, and you know, provide feedback from the trainees to the rest of the group. So it's not, you know, just lip service. I mean, she's there. And the other thing that they've done recently is, you know, all six centers are having a trainee meeting in Pittsburgh. What's the date? February 8th. And the trainee committee, you know, first of all, they treated the new centers as second-class citizens. They were going to let us have 10 people come, and they were going to have the old centers going to have 25 people come, and we were like, what? And one of the things the trainee committee did was, you know, actually poll people to see how many people really wanted to go, and ended up getting a good representation from our center there.
Whether it's organizational or whether, and I also think it needs to be on a scientific level, because if there, yes, there's a lot of organization that's involved in setting this up, but at that point, I think the trainees, postdocs, and graduate students really want something that will amplify their experience and allow them to make contacts that are important for their future career. And as you said, I think it's a very good idea talking about, you know, how do you look for a job? What? How do you write a really good grant? Although you should know that by now. But
I think the trainee committee also, I think as Isabel said, gives the trainees a voice, and it also gives us a unique perspective on what's going on. And I think Sue Becker had said she was in one of the meetings and was, you know, said that some of the trainees felt like they didn't really know where they fit and what they were doing and what was happening. And you know, for our perspective, that's important to know. And I think the training committee is a good place for that to kind of reveal itself, that maybe things aren't happening in the way they should, because some of the people know they're in a lab and know they're coming to Nashville. But it needs to be more than that. Yeah, some people thought they were going to Memphis.
April, if I can respond to what you suggested, there were some frustrations, perhaps, in, just like in the center as a whole, in getting started. But I think that the trainee committee as a group and the trainees more broadly, when we met together, had a lot of interest in taking advantage of what you guys have set up here scientifically as a center. It just took some time to get everybody together. And as Isabel said, we really didn't even have a trainee committee until after the last site meeting. But I think, as you'll hear from us, there's a lot of science that we're planning to do, whether or not you like it.
Yeah, I just say one point. Actually, like we're going, so now we have some 10,000 funding, and then we're going to use it like as a, like a, to provide trainees to be able to propose their own research. Like so, the money will be just like a like starting funds for them to buy do some pilot studies. Yeah, so Lian actually she's going to talk more about it. Later.
Have you considered including some of the teachers and educators also? Some of them are actually in a stage of their career that is similar to what we say a grad student or a postdoc, and they could actually help enrich your experience so that the science already starts from the beginning being influenced by the experiences and the needs that they have in the classroom.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Oh, so yeah, let's actually we prepare like each member of the committee that has something to say. So maybe so we were talking about the website, and I think I'm wondering whether Paul want to put something.
Yeah, so it's good to hear that the website's getting going with the wiki. We talked a lot about. It'd be a great thing for all the trainees to get a picture and a bio of like what their research is, get it up in a centralized place, so we can start sort of using that as a resource to form connections on our own. And maybe someday we'll have one of those, you know, little graphics with the lines going between us. So But yeah, just talking about ways that we can informally connect, and you know, it's great to come to a meeting like this and be able to meet people in person, but going forward, it's going to be nice to have an online way of doing that, something a little bit lower cost. So anyway, that's all I have to say about that.
Okay, so Gary, if that's one last quick remark before we go into Howard.
Okay, I just wanted to say, what? The trainees have more.
Another trainee.
Roger. But before, I wanted to mention that, you probably know this, but in Penn we have the Golden Greeble Award, which is, we have a small fund where we, a trainee will say, I would like to go visit so-and-so's lab for a couple of weeks to do research on X. And that's worked out really well. I mean, when Carrie Joyce was in Penn, she got two or three papers out of a two-week trip to Brown. So that's another thing you might consider using your 10K for.
Well, actually, that's a great idea. We had Mark Mayford, I don't know if he's still around, in our session, and when we were talking about the various ideas for the 10K, he first suggested that we all buy beer, and it would help us interact more. But we came up with something, I think, a little better. But and that was to put out a call for proposals. And in fact, it's written up, and if there were PowerPoint, you'd see it. Due March 1st, we're suggesting that you ask for $1,000 or less. This is for trainees only. I consider teachers as trainees as long as they're at that point in their career where they don't have a formal position. I think that that's perfectly fine. And the idea is to submit a proposal for travel, for pilot funding for a little project, or a workshop, because there are other people who are really interested in having something that was perhaps more, you know, to the goal of training. And what you don't yet know is that members of the faculty will be evaluating these. And each network can select someone as faculty, or we will select the directors of the network. there's only $10,000, so I think a $1,000 cap is good, but that's what we've decided should happen.
Together, the Golden Greeble Award, and we send this call for, you know, please send a short proposal and we'll give you money. I think we said we'll give you $2,500. People will ask. People don't ask. Trainees are funny that way. They don't ask. So what had to happen is that the PIs had to say, hey, how come your students aren't asking for money? And then the PIs started kind of listening to their students' ideas for something, and then go like, oh, you should turn this into, you know, you could go there and learn about this. So when your student says, oh, I need to read about this, say, well, how about inviting that person to come here and have a workshop? Or how about putting together these, you know, so I really want to encourage the PIs to listen to what your trainees would like to do and just suggest that, because we're talking about short, you know, one-page proposal. It's and it, from experience, when people do this, it really makes a difference. You know, they really learn something new that they wouldn't have, and it's, those are great things for the centers to do, for the center to do, you know. So it's money well invested, but you know, you will need, the PIs will need to encourage their students to do it.
Are we done on trainees? All right, Howard, motion capture.
The motion capture, we just discussed existing capabilities and usages. Projects range from brain-computer interface for reaching and grasping, to driving fatigue, to full-body spatial orientation experiments, to force field adaptation and EEG. We have the facility very well used. There are 12 ongoing projects at the moment. At the moment, simultaneous EEG and motion capture is up and working. We're struggling just a little bit, but we will get past this, integrating other devices with these ongoing simultaneous motion capture and EEG recordings. We also talked just a little bit about future possibilities. Of course, under the auspices of TDLC, we put in a ONR equipment grant for $1 million, which we'll hear about in the spring, hopefully before the site visit. And this will extend capabilities in two major directions. We'll have top-end virtual reality, visual and haptic simultaneously with motion capture and EEG. We'll add eye tracking, and we will also link motion capture and EEG with fMRI at the UCSD fMRI Center. Very exciting possibilities. As I say, it would be wonderful if we get this in here before the site visit. Rich Sutton, I think, articulated in a very elegant way some broad issues that the facility could address. For example, and I in particular love this one, how might reward processing be visible in the EEG? So the idea, of course, is to measure moment-to-moment EEG dynamics related to reward processing. And then the question is, how do we know that EEG dynamics is really related to, say, striatal dopamine? And we do have ways in which we can begin to address that and are addressing that via experiments with Parkinson's patients who are in a dopamine-depleted state, where it is known that there are cortical EEG abnormalities in the dopamine-depleted state that are at least partially reversed when given their dopamine repletion medication. So there are just lots of possibilities, lots of interest, and I think the facility will just get stronger as time goes on.
So I just wanted to real briefly talk about what happened in the session where we were discussing high-performance computing and data storage. The first point is that Vanderbilt has something which is called a Beowulf system. So it's this suite of about 2,000 processors. And the general idea is that people or a center kind of buys into this, and you may buy 20 processors. And then the nice thing about it is you can run 300 processors in doing, say, burst activity. And so the Acre group, which is a Vanderbilt High Performance Computing Center, has kind of put an offer on the table that if people in the center want to be able to have use of this facility, it would mean, you know, a modest investment from the center. They'll kind of give people some free access if they want to try it out. So at this point, you know, I can send out some more information to everybody about what the capabilities are. The nice thing about this, essentially, it's like a supercomputer with very low kind of startup cost, both monetarily and in terms of time. So most supercomputer centers really want you to do parallel jobs. The way I use it, I do it stupidly parallel. I run 100 jobs that I would run serially. I run them all at once, and instead of having to wait 2 weeks, I get something in by the end of the day. So it's a really a nice facility. If anyone's interested in it, you know, why don't you just email me? Because I need to get an idea of how many people are interested in it, and then we can try to flesh that out.
So, yeah. Tom, was Reagan going to speak on this issue as well?
I have one other comment about storage.
Can you run 2,000 copies of MATLAB?
Yes. There's some licensing issues we have to work out because we have a MATLAB site license at Vanderbilt, and I think if we say that it's all part of a project that's headed by me and Isabel, then it's fine. Yeah, we have a site license, so we have an infinite number of licenses. So, yeah. We do. No, we don't have. We can have as many copies as we want. We do. Yes. Yeah, that's what we have. No, we bought. We don't have a license server. No, we don't. They're not pulling licenses. We used to have that. Now we have a site license.
Tom, this is empirical, right? If you're right, you could send out the information to people.
Yeah. So if people are interested, let me know.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, no, we went through a lot of stuff discussing with them, but they do have a site license option that's just as many copies as you want. It's about $100,000 a year, but they have it. Yeah, no, it is a bargain. The other issue is the data grid, and I think everyone's heard about this. And it, I mean, to be honest, it took me 2 years to really kind of figure out what the data grid was all about. But the simplest form of this is that imagine having a folder on your desktop that's linked to a server, but it's not a server down the hall, it's a server that everybody has access to, right? It's essentially what, you know, the basics of a data grid is, right? So whether it's sharing data or sharing documents, right, it's just there and it's available. And I mean, it's really not that complicated conceptually. The details are really complicated, but the way this thing is set up is that you can kind of create these places to store data, to store documents, have everybody access them. One of the things we've had difficulty with this in the center when we have to do reports is that people start sending around, you know, multiple versions, and you know, the latest version is version 20, and Gary's editing version 14, and so it ends up being a problem. So this is a central place where everything is sitting and everyone has access to, and there's locking and everything that can control things. And then on top, so that's the simplest part. And you can do, on top of that, have things get much more complicated with having access depending on your IRB approvals and IACUC approvals, and make things accessible to the entire world when you want to archive data, or have things accessible just to a small group. Right, so it really is a cool technology. And the one thing that is really exciting is we had some people from Vanderbilt's group talking with Regan and about possible collaborations kind of on a technological level. So Vanderbilt's group is a bunch of high-energy physicists, and so they're really concerned with rapid transmission of tons of data, like terabytes up to petabytes of data. And Regan's group is really, you know, focusing on what people have access to, but they're going to try to marry their technologies and really be able to get the best of all the worlds. But
I just wanted to know if you have a place we can have a stimulus archive. I think it'd actually be really useful. We talk about connecting modeling with behavior. So is that something that's in place? But is there something in place we can start to? I mean, is the structure there? I know what the grid is, but what's the infrastructure at this point?
We're planning to have this data sharing facility running by the site visit. There are two ways we're going to implement this. One is we're going to put actual storage at three sites, 10 terabytes at UCSD, 10 terabytes at Rutgers, 2 terabytes at Vanderbilt. That data storage will be integrated into this data grid, and then we can decide who's allowed to store data where. You can build a collection behind the storage system at UCSD. We'll have a tape archive, so we can have a long-term preservation environment for it.
But I'm making a distinction between data and stimuli, which are much larger. 2 terabytes could be eaten up quickly if we load up movies and audiovisual stimuli, but that could be incredibly useful for people that want to share and do common kinds of experiments across different animals, across people, across modeling. And so we might want to think about some kind of way we can have something. It doesn't have to have the same kind of data redundancy, but it's a different kind of infrastructure to some extent.
The challenge is we need the storage area for active use of the data versus a very large archive for the massive amounts. That's what the tape archive provides.
Well, this wouldn't be, but it'd be something where people would be able to download it if they need it.
Correct. You can directly access the tape archive through the same interface you use to get to the data on disk. It just takes a little longer.
What's the bandwidth?
The bandwidth depends upon which site you're sitting at. Some of the institutions have very low bandwidth. At SDSC, it's 10 gigabits per second.
But Mike, I think for what you're thinking about, essentially data and stimuli are the same thing. It's just the amount of space you need. Is it two terabytes enough, or do you need? I mean, these things are scalable to 96 terabytes or 48 terabytes. So it's just how much money we have right now to put these in place. One of the things that, I mean, Reagan said that people can do is if Brown has a server, you can actually stick the technology on an existing server to make that server part of the larger grid. It does mirroring, so if you want to access a file that's actually sitting at UCSD or Vanderbilt and you're going to be actively using it, it creates a local copy, and you can edit the local copy, but then it automatically updates the other copies that may be sitting places, so you're not always transferring things over the net. So all of that's kind of hidden from the user. It just happens automatically. But so a lot of the issues is how much storage, and these things are scalable up to large amount. I mean, the one at Vanderbilt, they're really seriously talking about petabyte storage over the next five
5 years.
We're quite interested in identifying the sites that already have large storage systems and then working with them to install the data grid software so other participants in the project can also access that data.
Thanks. So let's shift over to, we sort of skipped over the education, outreach, translation section, which we're going to add together with the teaching panel that we did yesterday, and Terry can take the lead on describing those.
Okay. So first, I want to announce to everybody that the town hall meeting that the center is organizing, entitled The Science of Educating, will be held on March 3rd at the Salk Institute at UCSD, and everybody here is invited to come. In fact, what's the protocol for people who want to come from outside UCSD, from San Diego? We're having this town hall meeting, and you know, obviously the local people who are going to come will be able to, won't need any special expenses, but suppose that someone wants to come from Vanderbilt, for example. In fact, are you coming?
I don't have an answer to this question.
Okay.
I mean, what's the protocol? We'll have to come up with one.
Right. We're going to have registration site up, and so anybody. In fact, we're going to invite everybody. You know, from the school. Teachers, school district, superintendents. Paula has a big long list of people.
Do you have a budget?
Suppose that you wanted to come, and just hypothetically, okay?
Right.
What would you do?
I would ask you. I would. And what would you say?
Right. Well, I would say...
I think the executive committee needs to talk about
this. Ask Gary.
And whether we need to have... The executive committee needs to have a discussion about whether we need a budget to have, you know, guests. Yeah. We haven't had that discussion yet, but we need to have.
Okay, we're budgetless. No, we do have a budget.
That's a little easier. So if you folks in the education school and the Institute for Learning at Vanderbilt have teachers you want to send, that maybe you have a network of teachers here, I don't know, that you want to send, that at least their participant support costs. If you're already in the center, then it's not. So the cool thing about participant support costs is that they don't carry overhead, and so that's, and you can eat with them, things like that.
Okay, well, this town hall meeting is really meant to explore the ground that our center is really built upon, which is interaction between teachers, educators of all sorts, and the researchers. And so this is really our opportunity to reach out and reach in reach. And in fact, perhaps Paula would be the best person to give you an overview of what we're planning.
Well, it's very interesting that there have been a number of meetings recently that have the focus of the interface between neuroscience and education. And if you look at the programs for most of those meetings, they've been a group of neuroscientists who are doing research that they think have implications for educators, and educators basically coming to listen. So the goal of this meeting is to have as many heavy hitters and superstars from the education world with a lot of different areas and levels of expertise, from the federal level, from the state level, from the level of superintendents who really run large school systems, teachers, and heads of departments of education, meaning departments that teach teachers. So to get different perspectives on the social issue that we all are facing, and that is a crisis in education. So the Science Network has become a specialist in raising and creating these town hall interactive meetings on issues of particular relevance to society that scientists have the potential to learn about and also impact. So as Terry said, you know, we thought about calling it the having a meeting on the science of learning, but that suggests a one-way street from the learner and the learner's brain, or the science of teaching, which is another one-way street, you know, teachers, you know, how people teach. And then we ended up with Terry's suggestion, which is the science of educating, with the real goal of making this interactive in terms of thinking about an interactive system between teachers and learners, between the brain and environment, between scientists and educators. And so we have a very excellent panel so far put together that I think is very, very unusual, and that we will really be hearing perspectives of people who have enormous influence in their own educational communities, as well as scientists who have enormous influence in our scientific communities. So that's the goal of the meeting, and it will be a town hall meeting. Our other goal is to, of course, have a very interactive audience of people who have, we call them stakeholders. Some people don't like that word, but there are a lot of stakeholders in the issue of education in our country and in the world. So trying to represent those, and hopefully it will be just the first of meetings. And it's very critical for this center, because we really do have as our core, ultimately, to understand learning so that we can have helpfully affect outcomes of learning and make them better. But we also recognize that we, as scientists, live in a vacuum from the real world of what goes on in classrooms. And so we have a tremendous goal of learning earlier in our research agenda what has better potential to ultimately affect education.
So how many people here have gone to the Science Network website and downloaded some of the symposia and interviews with scientists? Okay, there's two people, three, four, five, six. More and more people are admitting it. So, Roger, could you describe the format of the meeting, how it's going to be actually run?
Two things that prompted it. First of all, a lot of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center information is actually on the TDLC website. It's not on...
No. I'm talking about TSN. How many people have actually gone to TSN?
So the things that we've done so far have included meetings about stem cells that we did just before Prop 71 happened. We've done two stem cell meetings since then. We did a couple of meetings that were called Beyond Belief, about science and religion and those sorts of issues. There's one coming up called Hooked, which is on the science of addiction. I've already told you I'd love to do something on the musical brain, because I think that's a natural for this group as well.
And waking up to sleep?
We did one called Waking Up to Sleep, which was obviously about sleep, from various aspects. But the whole idea is to bring people from different disciplines together who would normally not talk to each other, would normally come in, give a talk and leave, but to actually have them interact so that there's a learning process going on. And I think it's been reasonably successful. We get a huge amount of traffic, particularly on the science and religion ones, as you might expect. There were when the story about that one came out of the New York Times, there were over 3 million hits on the website immediately. There was just massive data going out, and the most recent one, the same sort of results, with hundreds of blogs that get started. That's the really interesting part of it. A lot of people start using the things and blogging them. And this, of course, in the age of democratic piracy, even though we do put these things on the website, they get ripped off anyway, and they're all over YouTube. And there are little sections that people pull off on YouTube and that are being... You know, they've got 400,000, 500,000 views on them. So it gets a lot of traffic. So if you're talking about something which is actually about people's homes, their kids, learning and so on,
these are issues that
should get a lot of traffic, a lot of traction. So, and the idea, as I said, is to have a series of panels, which are just really very brief talks, minimizing the amount of presentation and having more conversation than presentation. and bring all these different people from groups who would normally not talk to each other, bring them together, have a conversation, and see if we can find some common ground and some strategies for dealing with all this information. So it's just a conversation.
So I really recommend that if you haven't yet looked at the website and downloaded some of these programs, you should. One of the things that I didn't expect as starting with the first stem cell symposium is the drama of it. There are real confrontations where people really stand up and you can almost feel, it's palpable, the emotional charge. And obviously, we're dealing with issues that are very important for people's, their children and their what it is that their beliefs, what is it that they really want to happen. And so we're hoping that this will happen for the town hall as well. And everybody here who would like to come to it, I think, should. And we'll find some way of doing that, even if you're not in San Diego. Okay, well, so that's part of the formal presentation. In our breakout, we covered many, many different areas, and we heard from a lot of different people. One of the issues had to do with inReach. And Javier had some very eloquent things to say about his experience with going into the early child education center with Ruby the robot, the social robot, and his interactions with the teachers and what he's learned from the students, from the toddlers, as they interacted or not with Ruby and with Curio. So this is something that I think many of us could benefit from, and we should try to develop, as Hal Pashler's doing this at the Price School. And actually, this is a question about Vanderbilt. Have you had any interaction with your local schools? Why not?
Lack of budget. No, it hasn't come up. It hasn't been. I mean, we could discuss this. It just hasn't been one of the goals that we set out for ourselves. I mean, Tom, do you want to add anything else to this? It just hasn't come up. That's part of it. Is it? I think it is harder for some of what Tom and I do in our labs to think of easy projects to get in the schools. Doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that it's impossible, but it could be done. Yeah, I mean, Penn has, not at Vanderbilt. So as part of the network, they do have interactions in schools. Yeah, Jim Tanaka set up a face camp with children coming and doing at Victoria, University of Victoria, doing activities that had to do with face perception and learning about facial expressions and all of this. So there is some of this. It's a bit harder for us at Vanderbilt to think of that. But in the future, I think we could think of it.
See, Terry, you weren't thinking in terms of networks. You asked about a university. Don't think in terms of universities. Think about the networks and the way we can all interact independent of it being a particular institution. So I think that'll push us more where we want to go on things.
So Mike, why don't you elaborate on that point we spoke about earlier in terms of the value-added thing?
So I think centers have a particular challenge, which I think many are aware of, but it comes up anytime you have a center this large and you have limited resources necessarily, no matter how enriched the center particularly is. In this case, because of the way NSF has done it, we really have limited resources. And at the beginning, of course, is this frantic, let's get as much stuff down so we can convince them to go forward. And a lot of that work was in place or things that people were thinking about. But now we're at this next phase where we're trying to generate scientific ideas and connectivity. And that's great. And I think a lot of interesting ideas have come out. People are making a really great effort to try and connect things in different ways. And a challenge I know we face in Penn, I'm sure people involved in centers are always facing, is networks, of course, involve both growth of connections. People wanted more lines on the diagram, but they also involve pruning. Right? Effective networks, we're going to have to strategically think not just in scientific terms, but in the fact that we have limited resources, both financially but also personally, right, in terms of all of us. You can't do everything. And for many of us, this is new directions to go, which is part of the point of the center, and that's great. But how we most effectively allocate not just financial resources, but administrative resources, physical resources, student trainee resources, because often these things get done because of the trainees, not because of the PIs. And all those questions are going to be very difficult. They're sort of sociology of science questions more than the scientific questions where, in an ideal world, all these great things we talked about we'd get to try and do. I think it's a really big challenge for the success of a center, and it's important for us to keep thinking about that as we move forward. And, you know, where do we find value added intellectually and scientifically? And where do we say, well, maybe this should be put on the back burner for whatever reason or another? And so it's just pointing out that we need to continue to think about those things in different kinds of ways.
Well, I think it's a matter of priorities, too, right? So you're saying that with limited resources, you set your priorities. But I think that what Javier, his message is that you'll benefit much more than you imagine. So if you're setting priorities, even if it's something that's at the, you know, you have limited time, you can only spend a little bit of time, it might pay off.
You don't have to convince people in Penn. I think when Penn started, we all sat around a room. We're like, okay, we're all here. We do different kinds of things. Is this going to work? And I think now we're all incredibly enthused about the kinds of things that happen. I think it's great. It's just important. It's always, I think we all, because of the industry we're in, spread ourselves thin by nature. And the best center may be one in which we don't spread ourselves too thin. Students included. I mean, this is to everyone. Again, because you can generate this excitement and say you're going to start things. And some of it's just Darwinism because some things start and then they just die because no one deals with it. But we want things to be successful. And that may mean sometimes sitting down with a trainee or even a PI and saying, maybe we should, you know.
Have you ever thought of patenting your ideas?
Patenting my ideas? God, no.
Well, if you have so for example, if you have an idea that may help with improving retention of material, say for students.
Not an issue for me. If I thought of moving to Silicon Valley and starting companies, yes, but not.
Well, no, this is an issue that came up in our section, which is that how do you translate?
Sure.
Ideas that you may have in your lab to the real world, right? And it's partly the question of how do you get it into the classroom.
Brown has a new vision center, and it's one of the goals within the vision center. We've talked about a new kind of translational science. And it's not translational science into clinical practice, but in terms of practical applications, because there are many people at Brown doing vision work that have done that successfully. And so we're actually working with people at Google now to talk about having stronger ties and connections exactly in that kind of translational way. Because Google is a good connection for those kinds of issues.
Well, it also can be done not just through big corporations, but also through starting your own company.
Again, limited resources and time of all sorts.
Well, we actually have an example of that, which is the Scientific Learning Corporation, and Bill Jenkins has had a lot of experience with what's involved with taking something from the lab and trying to create a product out of it. And maybe this would be a good time for him to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was at a University of California, San Francisco, for about 16 and a half years, involved in a variety of different research projects, working with Mike Mersnick. And the collaboration with Paula, basically a laboratory, moving laboratory monkey brain plasticity projects into a practical application rehabilitation research project, which was largely conducted at Rutgers, which led to patents, which led to, gee, there's nobody out there that knows a bit about the science behind this that would likely commercialize it, which is why we did it ourselves. But it is, to your point, it is a huge time sink. And I'm no longer in the laboratory, I'm in a company, and have been for the last 12 years, trying to take the science and the engineering and the art and all of that and the educational components and combine it all to make something that can help kids. And, you know, so.
To be clear, I wasn't saying that it's a bad idea. In fact, I've encouraged different students or people to say that's what you should go do because that's what you want to do. But again, academics, as a rule, seem to be bad at prioritizing. And it's a bigger challenge when you come in with a center that's this big and all the great ideas that get kicked around and things. But, and that's my only point. Not that one particular mode or thing is better or worse than another.
But I think as a center whose part of your mission statement is translational neuroscience, right? So the end goal here, from what I've seen, is that, you know, not everything's going to be a hit. There are going to be a lot of science breakthroughs through the collaborative networks that you guys have set up. And many of those breakthroughs are not going to result in practical products. They'll result in great insight in science, and that's terrific, advancing, you know, our knowledge and so on about how the brain actually works. But some of the things that you folks are doing in your networks do have practical applications, and you should be thinking about, if we get one of those, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to get it out there? Is it going to sit in the lab, you know, for the next 15 years, and nobody except a small group of kids that come in to participate in a laboratory-based experiment are going to benefit from it? And, you know, if you really find something that's powerful, it's going to be a real challenge unless you sort of think about how you're going to deal with it. And there are a lot of different ways of dealing with it. I mean, from deciding that you're going to move out of academics and go make it happen yourself, to licensing it and partnering with companies that have experience in doing that kind of thing. But I do think it's worth contemplating the possibility that you're going to have a breakthrough, and what are we going to do about it when you do have it. And given that there are other issues that are social and intellectual property issues that come from collaborative experiences across networks and universities, because there are intellectual property stakeholders in any idea that comes up, particularly if it comes out of a collaboration. So your universities, if you have a patent, your universities are going to have a stake in that, right? Well, usually that most universities have a sharing arrangement with the inventors. So it's actually the university owns it, but you own it, and, you know, and so on. But it's worth thinking about.
So, of course, we're not talking to Mike. We're talking to the whole group. Yeah. So not put you on the spot. You just happen to have the microphone. But the experiences that we've had do help in thinking early in the process about what our goals are. And as Bill said, and as Terry and everyone has said, this is one of the mandates for this center. And some people will end up with great science that doesn't have any practical application right now. But there are other individuals within the center and other projects that have a lot of potential. And within those projects, early discussions need to be happening about intellectual property, about you know, the likelihood of scalability. And you can have the greatest idea in the world, and it can have the biggest effect on some population or a broad population or a small population. But if you can't get it out there in a form that's replicable and implementable in a cost-effective way, then it's still a small idea. It's not going to be transformative.
Just one other point that you might think about, since I hear a lot of comments about the lack of full funding by NSF. One of the things that came out of what we did is royalties back to both of the universities, to Rutgers University and to the University of California. And part of those funds went back to the dean, but part of them go back to the actual laboratory, or so that they can fund additional research. So one of the things that can happen if you are successful at translation is that you begin to build a pipeline of additional funding for further research along those lines that could go back into creating a funding, an independent funding source for the center.
So, Terry, you want to go back to the
To finish up that discussion, though, I think that the center is a resource for you, because most academics don't understand that the process of starting a company, or what happens in a company, or for that matter, what it takes to get a product
accepted by a school, right? How would you even go about doing that? Well, we have expertise here. We have people who have done it. We have people who can give you advice. So use us as a resource. If you have something that potentially will have an impact, explore it. And it doesn't take that much time to explore, and you might be able to get help. So that's why we're here. The other thing that we discussed was the difference between the standards that are used in your lab to prove something to your colleagues and the way that, say, a school system has to decide whether to accept the product or not is based on very different criteria. And it's not easy to translate your what you consider proof, that is to say, a trial based on, say, 25 children in your classroom, from a classroom in your lab, to scaling it up to 25,000 students. Things don't scale up the way that you would imagine. What are some of the reasons why they don't scale up is that, first of all, they don't have the same control conditions that you have in your lab, right? Just in terms of where are the students coming from, diversity of students, where are they coming from? Diversity of teachers. Well, they're not going to be able to, the teachers don't have the same expertise that you have with your particular stimulus or the way that you deliver it. It's going to happen much more chaotically. And so all of those things, it may not be robust when you translate it into a real classroom. And that means that it's really requires a completely different set of skills and a completely different set of social and political issues that arise if you actually want to have an impact on the real world.
But isn't that a part of why a lot of people who do our kind of research don't do translational research? Is because it seems like sometimes they require different skill sets, and particularly for someone like me who's a graduate student, there's a much longer time lag for getting things done. And as a fifth-year graduate student, I don't want to do a, say, 9-year PhD program. So I think that those are some of the issues, the basic issues of us being rewarded on the number of publications, often primarily within the area of research, that make translational research harder for primary science researchers to do.
Well, you point out a very good point, which is that we run on timescales that's measured in 5 years if you're a graduate student, 3 years if you're getting a grant, from NSF, or 5 years if you're lucky from NIH, and the timescale for actually getting something into the school is talking about decades, right? It's not something that you can easily fit into a single, for a trainee into a single kind of chunk of your life. But you could be part of the process. In other words, it may not be you by yourself, but it could be that you are the one who came up with the key insight, and you pass that on to the next graduate student or trainee, and then the PI gets involved. And this has happened in my lab, but we've started several startup companies as a consequence of basic research that was done that then got translated into something that was a practical product. But I can tell you from experience that it's often the case that you have to have someone who has a passion and someone who has to really take it upon themselves. This is their life goal. And if that doesn't happen, then nothing's going to happen. You have to have someone who really thinks that they can really make a difference. And in some cases, the difference is making a lot of money. And you shouldn't poo-poo that, because the fact is that it is a great motivator. And making money actually means that you've added value. Nobody's going to give you money unless what you have is worthwhile doing or worthwhile buying. And adding value is really what I think we're trying to do. So you should be proud of making money if you're, for example, putting together a patent that then leads to a product and you make money on it. You should feel that, this is something that is good and that more is better. Okay, so
Javier has a point over here.
Yes.
Just an interruption there for the...
I just wanted to say a few words about the meeting we had between teachers and researchers. And it was a very interesting one, but it pointed out the limitations that we have and the little progress that we've made towards really integrating our work with the education. actually, at one point in one of the breakout sessions, Michael, kept asking the same question. How does this, what's the implication of this for the classroom? How does this translate to the classroom? And it makes a point, which is, you know, in a way, we are not educational scientists, and our work may not have a direct implication for most of us in the classroom, yet we understand and we really want to integrate our work and to have implications in the classroom. And finding mechanisms to do that, I think that's the next step. Otherwise, it's coming to be that every year we meet with the teachers and the teachers go, yes, and how is this useful? We came up with two possible mechanisms. One was to really give incentives so that every project that is funded by the center, we have a researcher, a teacher, and a student put together a translated version of that project that could be easily understood. It doesn't have to be directly related to the practice of education, but it may be about the science that is happening and how the teachers could actually be used that's happening so that they can explain it to their students. Or it could be also about the science that happens to have implications to education. And the Brain Connection website could actually be a very good mechanism to do that. But one thing that the executive committee should consider is making it a requirement for these funded projects to have this translated component. And the other one mechanism that we thought about was for the teachers to give us like the question of the month, like a burning question that they really want to know about, like differences in brain between different genders, or is it better to have a practice exam early on in a classroom, or what's the best way to figure out whether the students are understanding or not? And to have that question and then have that, pass it around, to have a person that would be, again, a team of a researcher, a student, and a scientist, and try to get all the knowledge that we have in the center on that question, including the fact that we may actually not know, which is actually that's also very important. So these are just two mechanisms that we may actually want to consider in the executive committee.
Javier, I was wondering if there was any discussion about the teachers having some kind of formal voice in these processes, so that just like we have a trainee group, it'd be nice if there would be something like that for the teachers. Because I feel like the teachers come to our meetings and give up a lot of time to do this and really appreciate it, but it would be nice to integrate them more fully into our...
Yeah, we've been talking about creating a teachers network, parallel to the trainees network. We have some ideas for who might lead that, but a good thing to come up with would be, you know, what's the charge? I mean, as April was saying, you know, what are the students supposed to be doing in this network? So, you know, what do we want the teachers to be doing? Coming up with the question in the month is a good one, but as one of the possibilities, but also, you know, what opportunities are there for teachers in the center and for perhaps coming in, working in our labs, things like that. I'm sure a lot of the teachers don't know about the teacher education stuff that we've been doing, where they get to do a Brain Jensen Learning Corp thing for free and things like that. So organizing who would get to go. One of our things that we're doing is that people are speaking for free at the next Brain Expo. Where is that going to be, Paul? San Diego. And in return for people like Terry and Paula speaking for free, right, Teachers will get to go. And so the teachers need to you know, right. Have a way of sure. of finding that out and having a teacher's network
well,
as a
yeah. I, well, and for example, I mean, for stuff we do in our lab on face processing and expression recognition, it'd be nice to have the teachers involved on the ground floor of in developing our experiments, piloting our software. So I really would like to see the teachers involved early on in the process for projects where it's appropriate, and as opposed to an add-on sort of after the fact. And if there was a formal body or a recognized body that I could turn to, that'd be great.
Right. Okay, well, there's a similar issue that has to do with translating research into products and the issue of scaling up and having a small versus a bigger effect. That applies to this issue of teachers. We certainly can have a couple of local schools and local teachers who we appreciate come to this event and everything, but I'm thinking much bigger than that, and that has to do with how do you really scale up the impact that our center could have at a much greater level. And that is primarily, I believe, through teachers' colleges, to having partnerships and interaction much earlier on in terms of having an effect on what is actually taught to teachers. The other thing, of course, is continuing education courses for teachers. There's a tremendous interest on the part of teachers to learn more about the science of learning and teaching and educating. And there are some courses that are available already. The Brain Connection website, which is sponsored by Scientific Learning Corporation, has three teacher education courses, one on how the brain learns, one on how the brain learns to talk, and one on how the brain learns to read. We could have more. We could enhance those. We could do a number of things with them and have that be a real mission and goal to get those out much more broadly to teacher and education colleges or continuing education. So I keep thinking much bigger about this issue and the scaling up issue, and I think maybe it deserves maybe a subgroup of individuals within the center who are interested to sit down and really think about how we really do scale up the impact. Both on the one of the nice things about the Brain Connection website is it allows feedback from the community, and they get lots and lots of hits, how many hits do we get?
A couple hundred thousand a month, easy.
Couple hundred thousand a month. Okay, so Gary runs a column there. You know, it could be a much in which individuals from the center who have data that have been published, so we have control over, you know, the quality and everything, have the potential to write something in a format, maybe together, maybe with some input from teachers, that would be of great interest to teachers. And we need probably a better format for how we select what's going to be on there, but also to have more of an opportunity for feedback and maybe a discussion that comes in with these hundreds of thousands of hits of people who say, well, that's really interesting in my classroom, blah, 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 blah. So we have a much bigger impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm more or less coming at this through as a communicator. That's what I do with UCSD. I communicate with teachers in regards to math, science, and engineering, what we can do to attract more students, how to get more teachers involved. And I sat in Javier's meeting on this topic. And I agree with Paula and Bill. In fact, Bill and I see kind of eye to eye on this, pretty much the need for scientists to start communicating more of what they do, especially our charge. One of our charges with the center is communicating with teachers and how that enhances their education performance in the classroom. Teachers want to be allies with you. I hear that all the time from teachers, and some of the teachers in the audience, I'm sure, can attest to that. They're looking for an edge, any edge that they can get to do their job better. And as it relates to the brain and how the brain learns, they're all for that. What they aren't getting is communication from scientists, even interaction with scientists on how that relates to their job in the classroom. So the better that you as scientists can communicate what you're doing, and albeit I hear the problem that certain things aren't at this point viable to translation per se, but some of what you're doing is, and some of what I've been hearing at this meeting today, some of it's very exciting things coming down the pike. So the more that you can communicate, get teachers on your side, but they can't be on your side and be allies until they know what you're doing and how that's actually benefiting them in the classroom. So as Paula and William said, first of all, making use of the brain connection vehicle, getting maybe each quarter something that's come out of your lab that can be applicable or potentially applicable to teachers in their classrooms. And obviously, I know you're busy with your research and that taking the time to write something and also get maybe teachers' perspective on comments on this to include in the article may be time-consuming. And we discussed that also in our meeting. And what I propose, for UCSD at least, is that the University Communications has a actual public relations, media relations person. That's all he or she does is write on bioscience, what's coming out. And so when I get back, I'm going to investigate the possibility of a writer being assigned to the center to actually bird dog articles, helping William to get that posted on his website, which I'm sure is going to get really, really some good visibility, but also placing it on our website at UCSD so it gets further. And I would probably recommend the other centers doing the same thing at your institution, or maybe we can even collaborate on a center-wide type of article or communication in that regard. So, but my bottom line is more the communication, the better. Thank you.
David?
Well, I just wanted to point out that, you know, coming at this from the sort of basic science perspective, there are some disconnections that make it very difficult for me to see how this all fits together. On one hand, as a father, I am very intrigued by the possibility of making a difference in education. And this is big, this is important, this needs to be communicated. On the other hand, as a scientist, sometimes, you know, one of our biggest fears is that the 200,000 hits a month and that the PR does something that we really didn't intend to do, which is to try to make something more than it really is at this moment. And so one thing I would encourage and I would love to do is to be able to communicate with teachers in a way where they understand that this is a conversation. I'm offering my ideas, but it really is, you know, I'd like them to say, well, that's a great idea. I'd like to try that. And I'd like them to tell me it works. I don't want to be the one where they think I'm telling them it works because I've got a royalty coming back to my laboratory. I cannot do that. I mean, that's just not the way I do science. So I know that there's tension because we have different objectives here, but there's a lot of concern that, you know, what is the real goal, what is the objective, and what are our priorities? Because I think that needs to be very, very clear. And so, I, you know, one hand, I would love to figure out how things I might be doing could help in the classroom. But I want to do that in a way where the people with whom I'm communicating understand exactly sort of the parameter space that we're working in. So,
who, anybody like to speak to that? Paula? Okay.
Those are all great points, and I think that we need to differentiate this, the conversation we've just had in the last few minutes, from the a little bit earlier one. We're not necessarily saying that that what you're doing needs to be considered something that will turn into a practical product, or that you're saying you should do X, Y, or Z. But work on, let's say, Ruby, which is being published, would have, there'd be a lot of interest from teachers about what they're finding at a scientific level. I could probably go around the room for many people here and say, you may not have thought that this is interesting or important, but in the classroom, and it may never be translated into something that's important in the classroom, but teachers are the people who convey information ultimately to our children, and the extent to which they understand how brains work, how learning occurs from the level that scientists understand it, with the understanding that we don't have all the answers, but we're a lot further along than what their education was when they went to teachers' college. And so that's the real goal. How do we write something in such a way that it just over time helps to raise the level of education of the public, and within the public includes the people who have the biggest effect on our children? So I know there's been all these discussions and arguments, editorials at very high levels in science and Nature, about the translation of quote-unquote neuroscience or science in general into education. And I come back and say, could someone tell me how it would be harmful for a teacher to actually understand how synapses are formed? Would it be really harmful for them to understand some other basic principles about how movement occurs or whatever? So I don't think we have to think ultimately this is going to be a product, but rather we're thinking about educating what it is that we know and translating that at a level that is not going to be misinterpreted, but can raise the overall scientific knowledge base of our society.
But I think Dave is just saying we need to be careful. It's okay to educate people, but we don't want to say then, therefore, you need to change your teaching practice. And I don't think we would do that, but we need to be careful because it could be misinterpreted.
That's what I was trying to differ. That's what a dialogue is about. But that's how I was trying to differentiate that.
So NSF came back at us with this early on and said, how are you going to prevent, you've got the science network. What if that becomes a propaganda wing for the center, and suddenly all this junk gets out there and people start believing it? So we had to develop a whole flowchart for how information that came out of the center would get vetted before it was released. And so we have a process. The main aim of this process is to prevent any information from coming out of the center. So we try and streamline it where possible. But we do have avenues like the Brain Connection article, my column in the Brain Connection, which Nadine Gabb basically wrote the article that's coming out this week, I think. And I just introduce her. Here's Nadine Gabb. She does X, Y, and Z. And then any of you can write an article for this this column, and it's a great way to get your stuff out there.
Well, let me remind everybody that your very words right now are being recorded and will have an impact, because it'll be going out there and having untold consequences. Also, just to respond to the point of having concerns that, well, my research may be misinterpreted or have, I don't want it to be hyped, right? I mean, that's a concern we all have. Because, of course, in order just to just explain it to somebody, you have to simplify it. And that's always a painful process. But you have to understand that teachers are, in fact, working with a set of conceptual tools that may be completely even worse. I mean, in terms of mistakes and based on ideas that people had 20 years ago that we now know are completely wrong. So trying to replace those with something that's a little bit more up to date that you have more confidence in, even though you're not sure that this is going to necessarily be the final word, is probably doing a service.
Well, I hope at the town hall, for example, you make it everyone is really very equal, the equal footing. That when a teacher says, you know, in my 20 years of experience, if I don't give them a recess, they don't listen to me. You're not going to come back and say, yeah, but you don't know how synapses work. I mean, you know, there has to be an understanding that just because something gets piped down from this, you know, nature.com, they do have a lot of insight that, you know, those people never tried to teach it in a setting where the kids were jumping up and down. Just as you said before, the things that we're doing may or may not translate. We don't know. And it's very important that the people with whom we're communicating understand the limitations as much as we do.
And that, yeah, and that's the in-reach issue of actually, if in fact, Mooming Poo actually brought up the issue of the fact that optimal training is not continual stimulation, but rather training with intervals, spacing. And actually, we've known that for 100 years, but why is it that it hasn't gotten into the classroom yet? People should know about that.
Terry?
Yeah, so I just want to say, David, I hope your fears are completely unfounded, because I think, you know, the whole aim of the town hall meeting is to do exactly what you say. It's a conversation. It's not.
And I hope you'll be there. I don't know if you're concerned about time, Tom, but we are about 5 minutes away. So Scott had something to say. Jay wanted to say something. And since he's chair of the advisory the board, he gets to say whatever he wants. And then you want to close, Gary, I think. So perhaps we could do that. Scott.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to share a thought that often the most the best way, actually, to change people's thinking is to give them the right questions rather than fill them full of facts. And so that I think thinking in terms of letting people know what the right questions are, as we struggle to find out what the right questions are, because, I mean, science is fundamentally a process of discovering the right questions, actually. And would be something that would be naturally of interest to the wider public and certainly teachers. And it would also create an interest in the facts that underlie approaches to those questions.
Could you give that mic to Jay?
Can I just make one really quick comment? And I just want to amplify something that Paula had said about including people from schools of education. And to include them in the dialogue, because while a number of people at smaller teaching colleges are consumers of information, people at places like Vanderbilt are producers of information, or scientists looking at what happens in the classroom in particular content domains. And so I think we want to engage them in the discussion, not tell them how the brain works, simply.
Jay, I should say, by the way, that in the teacher session that we had yesterday, I think Javier, you'd agree, the teachers who were in there, it was a really extreme, it was a very, I thought, very productive exchange. So I don't see any initial problems in that area. But Jay.
Okay, I'm going to move back up to the overall
30,000 sort of feet
level, right here. And I just wanted to say, from my own point of view, and I think from the point of view of all of us on the advisory board, that we're really excited about all aspects of what you guys are trying to do here. And you know, yesterday afternoon, I made a few pointed comments. They are meant in a constructive, informative way. And, you know, I see the potential of what you're doing in some ways as fulfilling a vision that I and several other people have had for a long time. And it just seems like such a wonderful group people who have come together here around these kinds of issues and questions, and I just want you all to know that we see your involvement, your enthusiasm, your investment in this process, and we definitely support you fully in these efforts. I would like to just simply add, and this I think relates to the education kinds of questions as well as to the sort of the scientific sort of scope and vision of the center as a whole, that the enterprise that you're involved in here is truly a long-term process, right? The business of achieving some sort of integrated understanding about how we learn is something that, you know, people have been working on for a long time. And there's been accelerating interest and sophistication over time. And now, you know, the NSF decided to fund several centers to study this process. And that's a very exciting thing from the point of view of the engagement of our nation's sort of highest level of scientific thinking in figuring out where we should go in this. But you guys should think in terms of, you know, really being in this for the long haul. Hopefully you'll have 3 years of funding at the full level that you expected initially, that you will use to put yourself in a position where for the second 5 years of funding, you'll be able to, you know, really make solid progress on those initiatives that you've so carefully and I think thoughtfully articulated. And so I just want to make sure to leave you all with the sense that what you're up to is, you know, valuable, important, and that your commitment to it is certainly recognized by those of us on the advisory board.
Thank you, advisory board, for all the very helpful comments and elegant articulations of issues to look at.
Thanks. And a final benediction from our fearless leader.
I want to second that. Thanks to the advisory board. I've heard from several people that the most pointed, most insightful questions at some of the breakout sessions came from just Peter, Diane. No, from all of you. And I really appreciate you all coming. And I appreciate the rest of you all coming, the teachers and the ed tech people and the scientists and the students, and bringing your brains to work together on these on the goals of the center. But I especially want to thank Susie. Is she here? Susie. Ooh. Somebody go grab Susie. And I want to thank Tom for organizing this down to the last who's going where, when. About 95% of your time was scheduled by Tom. We appreciate that. That was an awesome task. And now, again, we can thank Susie. She did just a beautiful job on handling all the logistics of this meeting. As I'm sure you all feel, it was very well organized, and that's in almost 95% part due to Susie. Certainly, I didn't have that much to do with it. And I want to thank, even though he's not here, Nick Zeppos and Vanderbilt for hosting this. Nick, as many of you know, came up with $100,000 to fund this meeting. And so this is releasing money for science that we didn't have otherwise. And I think that shows an incredible amount of vision from someone whose background is a lawyer. To want to fund science in this way. I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah. I want to just say, you know, we do say that we're going to develop the science of the temporal dynamics of learning. What do we mean by that? Do we expect that in 10 years there'll be now departments of the temporal dynamics of learning? I don't think so. That's not what I think. But, you know, what we really want is that people that do research in teaching and learning and computational cognitive neuroscience, that all of that type of research become inundated with issues of the temporal dynamics of those processes, and that people, as Paula says, won't be able to talk about learning or teaching or cognitive neuroscience without considering issues of the temporal dynamics of the process. So I hope you've all been inspired by our vision to go back to your labs and your classrooms and start thinking about these issues. And I hope you all see the center, as been said several times, as a resource for you to use, especially the trainees. You know, you have 40 or 50 PIs here with very different perspectives on a lot of the same issues that you care about. And you should see us as, you know, one big happy family that will be happy to talk to you about these issues. And if you have some problem that you don't have the technique for, synchronize your research with someone who does. And I hope you all had fun. I hope you've been, again, inspired about to think about these issues in a new way, and I hereby close the second annual all-hands meeting of the Temporal Dynamics.
I wanted to thank Isabel and the student group also.
Okay, I'm sorry, yeah.
Many don't know that Isabel actually leveraged herself for the Zepos donation to our center, so I do want to...
You know, I remember talking to Nick about the importance of getting people out of, you know, your environment. And most of the people here are at UCSD, and it is surprisingly hard to get people to connect when you're next door. And so the idea was to get people in a real workshop mode, a real retreat mode, and I think we've achieved that, and I'm so really pleased with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. Yeah, I want to thank Isabel and Penn especially for providing the example we're all following. So, okay, now I hereby close the second annual all-hands meeting of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center. I wish you a safe trip home and happy new science.